This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of From Sand and Ash by Amy Harmon, performed by Cassandra Campbell. To the real Rabbi Nathan Cassuto, I have no words, only awe. Prologue, 24 March, 1944. Angelo must have slept in the damp grass beside the road for a while, but the evening was cold and his cassock was thin, and he awoke, shivering. Even that small movement made him moan, but at least the sharp pain along his right side revived him. It was dark, and his mouth was so dry he licked the dew from the grass near his face. He had to move in order to get warm, and he had to move to find water. He had to move to find Ava. He struggled to his feet and took a step, then another, telling himself that walking wouldn't hurt as badly as lying down. Each breath felt like fire, and he was pretty sure a few of his ribs were broken. The darkness and his bad leg made each step precarious, but he found the posture that hurt the least and settled into a sort of rhythm, limping along the Via Ardeatina toward Rome. At least he hoped he was going toward Rome. God help him if he was turned around. He could barely see out of his right eye. His left eye was swollen shut, and his nose was broken. No loss there. It had never been his best feature. He was missing 3 fingernails on his right hand, and the smallest finger on his left was broken. At one point, he stumbled and fell, only to catch himself on his oddly bent pinky. The pain had him retching and seeing stars, fighting to remain conscious. He gingerly pushed himself onto his knees so he could moan a prayer to the Madonna, begging her to help him just a little longer. She did, and he kept moving. It wasn't that far to the church of Santa Cecilia in Trastevere. 5 miles, maybe? But he was moving so slowly it would take him hours to reach it. And he had no idea what time it was. The darkness was welcome, if only to hide him. He was supposed to be dead, and he would be safer if people continued to believe it. He could only imagine how he looked, hair matted with blood and grime, his cassock filthy with gore and stinking of sweat and death. He'd been wearing it for 3 days. He looked like a messenger from hell instead of a member of God's army. He knew there was another church along this road. There was a church or 5 along every road in Rome. He searched his memory for the pastor's name, but couldn't produce it. There was a monastery nearby, too, and a school. He had placed a few refugees in each. Children. Jews. But the road was quiet. He hadn't seen a soul since the trucks carrying German soldiers, well-used weapons and empty cases of cognac had rumbled away, leaving the old quarry and the catacombs behind. There was new death in the catacombs now. Old ghosts would have no more claim to the caves of Ardeatine. It took him a painful eternity to reach the church, but he picked up his pace when he saw the fountain. He practically fell into it, face first, choking when he gasped in pain and inhaled a mouthful of water instead of swallowing it. It was brackish and would probably make him sick, but it was the best thing he'd ever tasted. He drank his fill and eased himself up, trying not to cry out as his shredded fingertips grazed the icy surface. He washed as best he could, cleaning the blood and dirt from his hair and his skin. If he didn't make his destination before sunrise, he wanted to make himself as presentable as possible, and the water revived him. He started in fright when a shadow loomed over him, only to realize it was just a man made of stone. A statue. The statue looked down in frozen compassion, hands extended but unable to help him. Angelo didn't know the name of the saint or the significance of the statue. The name of the church eluded him, too. But something about it, the solemnity of expression, the melancholy acceptance in the stance, made him think of Donatello's sculpture of St. George, and the day Angelo had found his calling. He'd been 13 when St. George had spoken to him. Not audibly. Angelo wasn't a fool or a seer, but St. George had spoken to him all the same. He'd been on crutches that day, his leg too sore to wear his prosthetic. The school excursion had tired him, and keeping up with the other boys was of little interest to him anyway. Father Sebastiano had brought them to the Palazzo del Bargello, and Angelo hadn't made it much farther than the entrance when he saw the statue. It was recessed and elevated so he couldn't touch it. But he wanted to. He got as close as he could and stood with his head back, gazing up at the statue as St. George stared off into an ancient distance, with an innocence that belied his armor and a fearlessness that contradicted the concerned slant of his brows. His eyes were wide and clear, his back was straight, and he faced the approaching threat with steadiness, though he looked barely old enough to wield a sword. Angelo could only gape at his face, transfixed. He'd stayed in that same position for a long time, ignoring the famed dome, the frescoes, and the stained glass. The enormity of the museum and all its wonders were reduced to that one sculpture. Now, more than a dozen years later, he stood peering up at a statue that wasn't Donatello's famed sculpture. Yet he beseeched him anyway. "Help me, San Giorgio," he said aloud, hoping the heavens were listening. "Help me to face what is to come." Angelo turned and staggered away from the fountain, back to the road that was as ancient as Rome itself, feeling the eyes of the unknown sculpture on his weary back. Angelo's thoughts returned to his champion, to the long-ago afternoon when things had been made so clear, when immortality seemed like a prize and not terrible torture. He hurt too much to be tempted by immortality now. Death sounded so much more inviting. That long-ago afternoon, he had eventually been joined in his contemplation of St. George, but was unaware of it until the man spoke up, telling him the story behind the art. "George was a Roman soldier, a captain of sorts. He would not renounce his faith in Christ. He was promised gold and power and riches if he would simply worship the gods of the empire. See, the emperor did not want to kill him. He valued young George very much, but George refused." Angelo had pulled his eyes from Donatello's sculpture. The man beside him was a priest like Father Sebastiano, older than Angelo's father, but younger than his grandfather, Santino. The priest's eyes were bright, and his hair neatly groomed. His face was kind and curious, but his hands were clasped behind his back, his very posture bearing solemn witness to his self-denial. "Did he die?" Angelo had asked.
"Yes, he did,"
the priest answered gravely. Angelo had supposed as much, but the truth still wounded him. He had wanted the young hero to be victorious.
"He died, but he defeated the dragon,"
the priest added gently. That hadn't made any sense to Angelo. Then he wrinkled his nose in confusion as his eyes returned to the sculpture and the huge shield in George's hand. He thought this was a true story, and there was no such thing as a dragon. "The dragon?" he asked. "He fought a dragon."
"Evil,
temptation, fear. The dragon is a symbol of the battle he must have waged within himself to stay true to his God. Angelo nodded, understanding perfectly. They fell into silence once more, staring at the sculpture of the soldier brought to life by a master's hand.
"What's your name, young man?"
the priest had asked him.
"Angelo," he answered. "Angelo Bianco." "Angelo, St. George lived more than 1,500 years ago, yet we are still talking about him. I think that makes him immortal, don't you?"
The thought had moved Angelo to tears, but he tried to blink away.
"Yes, Father," he whispered. "I do."
"He risked everything, and now he is immortal."
Angelo groaned, the memory making his stomach twist. Oh, the irony. Oh, the incredible, terrible irony. He, too, had risked everything, and he may have lost the only thing he would trade his immortality for. As dawn started to creep into the eastern sky, pale light falling over spires and campaniles onto the eternal city, Angelo finally reached the gates of Santa Cecilia. The bells of Lodz began to ring as if to welcome him back, but Angelo could only cling to the iron spires and pray that, by some miracle, Eva waited for him inside. Mother Francesca discovered him a few minutes later, sitting with his back against the gate as if he'd been propped there by Satan's henchmen. She must have thought he was dead, because she cried out in horror, crossing herself as she ran for assistance. Angelo was too tired to reassure her. He watched through swollen lids as Mario Sonnino appeared above him, checking his pulse and crying out instructions to several others to carry him inside.
"It's not safe."
Angelo struggled to speak. Mario was not safe outside the gate. Mario was not safe inside the gate.
"Someone could see you,"
Angelo tried to warn him, but the words were sloppy on his lips.
"Take him up the stairs to Eva's room,"
Mario commanded.
"Where's Eva?"
Angelo asked, forcing the words out, needing to know. No one answered him. They took the stairs quickly, and Angelo cried out as his ribs protested the motion. He was laid carefully on the bed, and Eva's scent rose up around him.
"Eva,"
he asked again, louder this time. He peered through the eye that wasn't completely swollen shut, trying to see, but the shapes were blurred and the people were ominously silent.
"We haven't seen her for 3 days, Angelo,"
Mario finally answered.
"The Germans took her."
24 March, 1944. Vietasso.
"Confession. My name is Bathsheba Rosselli, not Eva Bianco, and I am a Jew. Angelo Bianco is not my brother, but a priest who wanted only to protect me from the very place I now find myself. The first time I met Angelo, he was a child, like me. A child with eyes that had known too much disappointment for someone so young. He didn't speak for a long time after he arrived in Italy. He just watched. I thought it was because he was American. I thought it was because he didn't understand. It makes me laugh a little to think of it now, how I would act things out and speak so loudly, as if there were something wrong with his ears. I would dance around him, playing my violin and singing little songs just to see if he would smile. When he did, I would hug him and kiss his cheeks. There was nothing wrong with his ears or his comprehension. He understood me perfectly. He was just listening, observing, learning. Camillo, my very patient father, would tell me to leave him alone. But I couldn't. I simply couldn't. I realize now how the pattern never changed. I danced around him for years, trying to get his attention, wanting only to see him smile, wanting only to be near him, wanting only to love him and be loved by him. I was rebelling even then, pushing back against the fear, though I didn't recognize it. Rebellion was always my biggest ally, though sometimes I hated her. She looked like me and hurt like me, but she wouldn't let me give up. When fear took my reasons for fighting, rebellion gave them back. My father told me once that we are on earth to learn. God wants us to receive everything that life was meant to teach. Then we take what we've learned, and it becomes our offering to God and to mankind. But we have to live in order to learn. And sometimes we have to fight in order to live. This is my offering. These are the lessons I learned. The tiny acts of rebellion that kept me alive, and the love that fed my hope, when I had nothing but hope itself. Eva Rosselli. 1929. Chapter 1. Florence.
Santino has a grandson. Did you know that?
Eva's father asked.
Nonno has a grandson? Eva asked.
Yes, nonno. Though he isn't really your nonno. You know that too, don't you?
He is my nonno, because he loves me so much, Eva reasoned.
Yes, but he isn't my father, and he wasn't your mamma's father, so he isn't your grandfather,
her father explained patiently.
Yes, Babbo, I know,
Eva said crossly, not at all sure why he insisted.
So Fabia isn't really my grandmother.
It felt like a lie to say such a thing out loud.
Yes, exactly. Santino and Fabia had a son, you see. He left Florence and went to America when he was a young man because there was more opportunity for him there. He married an American girl, and they had a little boy.
How old is the boy?
11 or 12. He is a couple of years older than you.
What's his name?
His name is Angelo, like his father, I think. But please, Bathsheba, listen for a moment. Stop interrupting.
Eva's babbo only used her long name when he was growing impatient, so she listened and held her tongue.
Angelo's mother died, he said sadly.
Is that why Nonna was crying yesterday when she read her telegram?
Eva had already forgotten that she wasn't supposed to interrupt.
Yes. Santino and Fabia want their son to bring the boy to Italy. He has had some medical problems, an issue with his leg, apparently. They want him to live here, with us, at least for a while. Santino's older brother is a priest, and they think the boy can go to the seminary here in Florence. He is a little old to start, but he was in a Catholic school in America, so he won't be too far behind. He may even be advanced.
Her father said this as if he were thinking out loud, rather than communicating anything Eva actually needed to hear.
"And I will help where I can," he mused.
"We would be friends, I think," Eva said, "because we have both lost our mothers."
"This is true, and he will need a friend, Eva."
Eva couldn't remember her mother. She died of tuberculosis when Eva was little. Eva had a vague memory of her lying very still in bed with her eyes closed. Eva couldn't have been more than 4 years old, but she could still remember the height of that bed and the elation of success when she pulled herself up and over the side while clutching her tiny violin. She had wanted to play a song for her. She had crawled to her mother's side and touched her feverish cheek, the high red color of a consumptive making her look like a rouged doll.
Her mother had opened her lids slowly, her eyes glazed and drugged, furthering the comparison. It had frightened Eva, the almost lifeless figure with glassy blue eyes staring straight up. Then Eva's mother had said her daughter's name, and it crackled and broke between her lips like old paper.
"Bathsheba," she had whispered,
the word followed by a cough that had racked her frame and made her body shake. The way she said the name, the rasping whisper, the way she sighed through the syllables like it was the last word she would ever say, had made Eva hate her name for a very long time. When her father would call her Bathsheba after her mother's death, she would cry and cover her ears. That's when her babo had started to call her Eva. It was all she remembered of her mother's life, of their very short life together, and she had tried to forget it. It wasn't a memory she cherished. She would much rather hold her mother's picture, pretending to remember the lovely woman with the soft brown hair and porcelain skin, holding Eva in her lap, sitting next to a much younger Camillo, no gray in his black hair, his face serious beneath smiling brown eyes. Eva had tried to remember being the infant in the frame, the tiny girl who sat in her mother's lap and gazed up intently at the woman who held her. But as hard as she tried, she couldn't remember that woman. Eva didn't even look like her mother. She just looked like her father, Camillo, with paler skin and rosier lips. It was hard to love or miss someone you didn't even know. Eva wondered if Angelo, Santino's grandson, loved his mother. She hoped he didn't love her too much. Loving someone and then losing them would be much worse than not having them at all.
"Why are you so sad?"
Eva asked, pulling her knees up under her long nightgown. She'd found Angelo watching the storm in her father's library, the doors open to the balcony, the rain falling heavily onto the pink flagstones below. She didn't think he would answer. He hadn't answered her yet. He had been living in their villa with his nonno and nonna for 3 months, and Eva had done everything in her power to make him her friend. She had played the violin for him. She had danced for him. She had splashed in the fountain in her school uniform and gotten scolded just to make him laugh. He did laugh sometimes, and that kept her trying harder. But he'd never talked to her.
"I miss my mother."
Eva's heart lurched in surprise. He was talking to her, in Italian. Eva knew Angelo understood when he was spoken to, but she had expected him to speak in English, like an American.
"I don't remember my mother. She died when I was 4,
she said, hoping he would say something else.
"You don't remember anything?"
he asked.
"My father has told me some things. My mother was Austrian, not Italian like my babbo. Her name was Adele Adler. A beautiful name, isn't it? I write it sometimes in my very best penmanship. Her name sounds like an American film star. She even looked like one a little. My father says it was love at first sight."
She was babbling, but Angelo was looking at her with interest, so she didn't stop.
"The first time my babbo saw my mamma, he was in Vienna on business, selling his wine bottles. Babbo has a glass company, you know. He sells his bottles to all the wineries. Austria has very good wine. Babbo has let me taste it."
She thought Angelo should know how sophisticated she was.
"Did she play the violin, too?"
Angelo asked hesitantly.
"No, Mama wasn't musical, but she wanted me to be a great violinist just like my grandfather Adler. He is very famous, or so Uncle Felix says."
She shrugged.
"Tell me about your mother."
He was silent for several seconds, and Eva thought he was going to revert to silence once again.
"Her hair was dark, like yours,"
he whispered.
He reached out slowly and touched her hair. Eva held her breath as he fingered a long curl and then dropped his hand.
What color were her eyes?
She asked gently.
Brown, like yours too.
Was she beautiful like me?
This was asked without guile, for Eva had always been told how beautiful she was and accepted it with a shrug. The boy tipped his head to the side and reflected on this.
I suppose, to me she was, and she was soft.
He said the word in English, and Eva wrinkled her nose at this, not sure she understood.
Soft? Soffice o grassa?
No, not grassa, not fat. Everything about her comforted me. She was soft.
The answer was so wise, so specific, so old, that she could only stare.
But your nonna is soft too, she offered eventually,
trying to find something, anything to say.
Not in the same way. Nonna fusses. She tries to make me happy. Nonna wants to give me love, but it isn't the same. Mama was love, and she didn't even have to try. She just was.
They sat watching the rain then, and Eva thought about mothers and lovely soft things, and the lonely way the rain made her feel, even though she wasn't alone.
Do you want to be my brother, Angelo? I don't have a brother. I would like one very much, she said,
her gaze tracing his profile.
I have a sister,
Angelo whispered, not answering her, not looking away from the rain.
She is still in America. She was born, and my mama died. And now she is in America, and I am here.
Your father is there with her, though.
He shook his head sadly.
He gave her to my aunt. She is my mama's sister. She wanted a baby.
She didn't want you?
Eva asked, confused. Angelo shrugged, as if it didn't matter.
What is her name? Your baby sister?
Eva pressed.
Papa named her Anna after Mama.
You will see her again.
Angelo turned his face toward her, and his eyes were more gray than blue in the shadow of the small lamp on Camillo's desk.
I don't think I will. Papa said Italy is my home now. I don't want Italy to be my home, Eva. I want my family.
His voice broke, and he looked down at his hands like he was ashamed at his weakness. It was the first time he had said her name, and Eva reached for his hand.
I will be your family, Angelo. I will be a good sister. I promise. You can even call me Anna when we are alone if you want to.
Angelo swallowed, his throat working, and his hand tightened around hers.
I don't want to call you Anna, he said with a sob in his throat.
He looked at Eva again, blinking away tears.
I don't want to call you Anna, but I will be your brother.
You can be a Roselli if you want to. Baba wouldn't mind.
I will be Angelo Roselli Bianco.
He smiled at that and wiped at his nose.
And I will be Batsheva Roselli Bianco.
Batsheva?
It was Angelo's turn to furrow his brow.
Yes, it's my name. But everyone just calls me Eva. It's a Hebrew name, she said proudly.
Hebrew?
Yes, we are Hebrei.
Hebrei?
We are Jews.
What does that mean?
I'm not sure exactly,
she shrugged.
I don't go to religious lessons at school. And I'm not Catholic. Most of my friends don't know our prayers and they don't go to temple. Except my cousins, Levi and Claudia. They are Jewish, too.
You aren't Catholic?
Angelo asked, shocked.
No.
Do you believe in Jesus?
What do you mean, believe in him?
That he is God.
Eva wrinkled her forehead.
No, I don't think so. Jesus is not what we call him.
You don't go to Mass?
No, we go to temple, but not very often, she admitted. My babbo says you don't have to go to a synagogue to talk to God.
I went to a Catholic school and Mass every Sunday. Mama and I always went to Mass.
Angelo hadn't lost the shocked expression on his face.
I don't know if I can be your brother, Eva.
Why?
She squeaked, perplexed.
Because we aren't the same religion.
Jews and Catholics can't be brothers and sisters.
Angelo was quiet, contemplative.
I don't know,
he admitted finally.
I think they can, she said firmly. Babo and Uncle Augusto are brothers, and they don't agree on very much.
Well, then, we will agree on everything else, Angelo said gravely, to make up for it.
Eva nodded, just as solemnly.
Everything else.
Why are you always arguing with me?
Angelo sighed, throwing his hands in the air.
I'm not always arguing with you,
Eva argued. Angelo just rolled his eyes and tried to shake his persistent shadow. She followed him everywhere, and he usually didn't mind, but he'd spent the morning teaching her to play baseball. Nobody in Italy played baseball, and now his leg was bothering him. He wanted Eva to go away so he could attend to it.
So what exactly is wrong with your leg?
Eva asked, noticing his discomfort. She'd already taught Angelo the basics of soccer, and though Angelo couldn't run very well, he could protect and defend. He was a superb goalie. Still, as much time as they'd spent playing together, he had never talked about his leg. And she'd been surprisingly patient, waiting for him to reveal the secret. She was tired of waiting.
There's nothing wrong with it, exactly. It just isn't all there.
Eva sucked in her breath in horror. A missing leg was so much worse than she had imagined.
Can I see? She begged.
Why? Angelo shifted uncomfortably.
Because I've never seen a missing leg.
Well, that's the problem. You can't see what isn't there.
Eva sighed in exasperation.
I want to see the part that is there.
I would have to take off my trousers,
he challenged, trying to shock her.
So?
She said saucily, shrugging her shoulders.
I don't care about your smelly underwear.
When he raised his eyebrows in surprise, she pressed sweetly.
Please, Angelo. No one shows me anything interesting. Everyone treats me like a baby.
Everyone did treat Eva like a tiny princess. She was doted on, and Angelo had noticed that she didn't especially enjoy it.
All right. But you have to show me something, too.
Like what?
She lowered her brows doubtfully.
My legs are just normal. My whole body is normal. What do you want me to show you?
Angelo seemed to ponder that for a moment. Eva was sure he was going to ask to see her girl parts. Nonna would paddle them, and Nonna would cross herself and get out her black beads and start praying if they were caught. But Eva was curious, too, and wouldn't mind having her questions about boy parts answered.
I want you to show me that book you write in, and I want you to read it to me, Angelo said.
Eva was surprised, but it was probably safer than show and tell, and she only had to think about it for 5 seconds.
All right.
Her hand shot out to take his in a brisk handshake. From Angelo's glower, she knew he was worried about the deal he'd made. Her willingness to shake probably had him thinking he was getting the raw end of it. He probably thought she wrote about him. She did, but she didn't care if he knew about it. Still, he shook her hand and began to pull up his right pant leg. All the other Florentine boys wore short pants almost year-round, but not Angelo. Angelo looked like a little man in his trousers and ugly black boots.
"I thought you had to take your trousers off," Ava huffed, not liking that she'd already been lied to.
"I just wanted to see what you'd say. You aren't a lady, that's for sure."
"I am, too. I'm just not a silly lady who makes a fuss about a boy's baggy underwear."
He stretched his leg out, the adjustable steel columns strapped to his knee and upper leg on one end and attached to a black boot on the other. Ava touched the adjustable braces with an outstretched hand, fascinated.
"It helps me walk. My papa made it for me."
His face changed at the mention of his father, the way it always did. Angelo's father was a blacksmith, and he had promised to train Angelo to make things out of metal, too. Angelo didn't need two legs to build things with his hands. But that had been before his mother died. His father was in America, Angelo was in Italy, and nobody would be teaching Angelo to work metal.
"Can you take it off?"
Ava really wanted to see him in all his legless glory. Angelo unbuckled the straps and moaned a little, as if it were a relief to loosen them. He pulled the prosthetic free, and Ava stared down at the leg that ended just below his knee, her eyes wide, her lips parted in a soundless "oh." Angelo looked embarrassed, and maybe a little ashamed, as if he'd done something wrong. She reached out and took his hand immediately.
"Does it hurt?"
The leather looked soft, and he wore a thick sock to protect his skin from the weight and pull of the contraption. But it wasn't like pulling on a boot, and the oddly shaped lump just below his knee was red and chafed.
"Wearing the metal leg is a little uncomfortable, but I like being able to walk. I used a crutch for a long time. The brace is adjustable, and it will grow with me for at least a few years. I can still use the crutch when my legs get tired."
"How did you lose your leg?"
"I never really had it."
"You were born without it?"
"My mother said the doctor thinks the cord in her stomach was wrapped around it early on, and it wasn't getting any blood. It didn't grow right, and parts of my leg died. They removed the dead parts after I was born."
He shrugged.
"Mama said it wasn't a big deal if I didn't allow it to be."
"Some of it grew right."
Ava's eyes were on the muscles of his bared thigh, and Angelo blushed and immediately began reattaching his metal leg so he could push his trousers back down. His embarrassment made Ava blush, too. She just wanted him to know his leg looked fine to her.
"I do exercises every day. I jump and lunge and squat so that my legs are strong. The doctors told me that the stronger I am, the more I can do. I am very strong,"
he added shyly, his eyes darting to Ava's face before he looked down again. She was impressed, and she smiled, nodding. Ava suddenly stood up and left the room. Angelo watched her go, probably wondering if she was done with him, but she was back before he was finished buckling the final strap. She held a book in her hands, and she sat down close to him on his bed. He scooted over immediately, almost falling onto the floor. She wondered if she made him feel shaky inside. She felt like that around him sometimes, but she kind of enjoyed the sensation. He glanced at Ava, and she recognized the look. Babbo looked at her like that when she did something he didn't understand.
"Don't you want to see my book?" she asked.
"I want you to show me," he insisted, not taking it.
"Okay. Well, this is my book of confessions."
She opened the soft leather cover and turned through the pages, not letting him get a very good look at any of them.
"You have very nice penmanship, but I don't read Italian very well. Speaking it is one thing, but I've only ever read in English."
Eva nodded, glad that he couldn't easily read her thoughts or her words.
"I thought it was your diary."
He sounded disappointed.
"Who are you confessing to?"
he asked. "Oh, it's definitely my diary, but I confess things. Very private things."
She waggled her eyebrows at him, letting him know that he was hearing very privileged information indeed.
Mostly, she just wrote about her day, but she had to make it sound good.
"Read one to me,"
Angelo insisted. "I thought you were shy," she said dryly. "You aren't. You are quite bossy, actually. I'm glad."
Angelo tapped the book, drawing Ava's attention from him to the pages.
"All right. I will read you the confession I wrote about you when you first arrived in Italy."
"About me?"
"Yes. You will like it, I think. I am so glad Angelo is here. I am tired of being with adults all the time. Babbo says I am smarter and more mature than children my age because I've grown up surrounded by old people. That's good, I suppose. But I'm tired of old people. I want to play hide-and-seek and tag. I want to have someone to tell my secrets to. I want to slide down the banister, jump on my bed, and climb out my bedroom window and sit on the roof with a friend. And not just the ones in my imagination. Angelo is only 11, 2 years older than I am, and I'm already as tall as he is. He's kind of small. Nonna says that is normal. Girls mature more quickly. She says he will catch up. But he is very handsome, and he has very beautiful eyes. They are far too beautiful for a boy, though. Of course, that is not his fault. His hair is curly like a girl's as well. He'll have to keep it short and never wear a dress. Otherwise, he will be prettier than I am. And I don't think I like that idea."
Angelo scowled at Ava, and she snickered at his displeasure.
"You are very handsome, you know," she teased, "even if your nose is too big for your face."
"I don't think you have to worry that I will be prettier than you," he huffed. "You're the prettiest girl I've ever seen."
When he realized what he'd said, his face flushed all over again.
"I didn't like that one," he said quickly. "Read me another."
And so she did. She read him confession after confession, and he listened as patiently as a priest.
1938. 17 November, 1938. Confession. Sometimes I'm afraid to sleep. I dreamed my old dream last night, the dream I have been having since I was 9 years old. The one I don't understand, but that seems to understand me. As always, it is dark in the dream, but the darkness is crowded. I can't see anything but the flash of moonlight through the small window high up on the wall, and the slats that ring the darkness on all sides. I am moving, and I am scared. I know I must reach the window. And suddenly my fingers are clutching at the ledge beneath the small opening, and the toes of my shoes are shoved into the slats that I've used as a ladder to reach it.
"If you jump, they will punish us."
Hands grab at my clothes, and I shake them off, kicking desperately.
"They will kill us," a woman wails below me. "You must think of the rest of us."
"You will die if you jump,"
someone else hisses. And the consensus grows around me. But I can't listen. My head fits through the opening, and the air against my face is like water, like life, a waterfall of cold hope. I open my mouth and gulp it in, unable to quench the thirst clawing at my throat, yet I'm fortified by it anyway. I force my shoulders through the window, clinging to everything and nothing, wiggling to free myself,
and I'm suddenly hanging head first over a world that is racing and clattering, yet I can still hear my heart pounding in my chest. Then I'm falling. Eva Rosselli. Chapter 2. Italy. Her father woke her, saying her name and shaking her fiercely, rescuing her from her dream.
Eva! Eva!
He was afraid. She could hear it. And his fear made her afraid, too. She opened her heavy lids and looked at him, and his face melted into relief.
Eva, you scared me.
His voice broke, and he gathered her up, her tangled covers between them, his arms circling her back. His neck smelled like sandalwood and tobacco, and the comfort she drew from the scent made her limp and drowsy.
I'm sorry,
she whispered, not sure exactly why she needed to be sorry. She'd been asleep, that was all.
No, mia cara. I should have known. When you were small, you would sleep so deeply, Fabia would lay her head against your chest to make sure you were breathing. I suppose I forgot.
After a few moments, he let her go, and she slumped back against her pillows.
I was dreaming, she said.
Good dreams.
No,
it hadn't been a good dream.
The same old dream. The one I've told you about before.
Ah, did you jump this time?
Yes, I suppose I did. But not with my legs, with my whole body. I fell through the window. I let myself fall. Then I woke up.
In dreams, we always wake up when we are falling. We always wake up before we land,
her father soothed.
That's good, because landing will be very painful. Landing might kill me,
she whispered.
Then why are you jumping in the dream? Why do you always want to jump?
Her father asked.
Because if I don't, I will die for sure.
That was the truth. In the dream, she knew it. Jump or die. Her father patted her cheek like she was 8 instead of 18, almost 19. And she grabbed his hand and kissed his palm. He closed his hand over the kiss, the way he used to do when she was little. He was almost to the door when she asked him,
Did I scream? Did I scream and wake you?
You screamed, but you didn't wake me. I was already awake.
It was 3 in the morning, and she noticed suddenly how old her father looked. It scared her, worse even than the dream.
Are you okay, Babbo?
She asked fearfully.
Sono felice se tu sei felice.
I'm happy if you're happy. It was what he always said.
I'm happy,
she smiled at him affectionately.
Then all is well in my world.
Again, what he always said. He switched off her lamp, and her room was bathed in darkness. But he hovered at the door.
I love you, Eva.
His voice sounded strange, like he was crying, but she could no longer see his face.
I love you too, Babbo.
Eva's father, Camillo Rosselli, knew what was coming. He thought he had sheltered his daughter from it, or maybe she was just Italian enough, young enough, naive enough, that she completely missed the gathering storm and thought only of dancing in the rain. Most of her friends had no idea she was Jewish. Eva didn't remember she was Jewish most of the time. She had no sense of being different. She'd noticed the cartoons mocking the Jews, the occasional derogatory sign and the articles in Santino's papers. Those things always infuriated her father. But it just seemed like politics to Eva. And politics in Italy was for the politicians, not the people. The people mostly shrugged and went about their lives. Sure, she'd heard Camillo arguing with his brother Augusto. But they argued constantly. They had argued at least once a week for Eva's entire life.
Jews are the pure blood of Italy. The synagogue preceded the church. Augusto would say. This is true.
Camillo would answer heatedly and pour more wine.
We lost friends and family in the Great War. All in the defense of our country, Camillo. Surely that counts for something.
Camillo would nod and sip, sip and nod.
I trust the fascists more than the communists,
Augusto would add.
I see no reason to trust either, Camillo would retort.
And that is where Augusto and Camillo would not see eye to eye, and they would spend the evening smoking, sipping, and arguing about Il Duce and the black shirts versus the Bolsheviks.
No freedom-loving Jew can support an ideology that uses force and intimidation to gain followers.
Camillo would point a long finger at his younger brother.
But Camillo, at least they don't seek to take our religion from us. The fascists are as disdainful of Catholic conservatism as we are. It's about nationalism. Revolution, even. Revolution rarely helps the Jew.
Augusto would groan loudly and throw up his hands in disgust.
When was the last time you went to temple, eh, Camillo? You are more Italian than you are Jewish. Does Eva even know our prayers? Did you even realize today is Shabbat?
Camillo would shift guiltily in his seat, but his answer was always the same.
I know it is Shabbat, and of course Eva knows the prayers. I am a Jew. I will always be a Jew. Eva is a Jew. She will always be a Jew. Not because we go to the synagogue, not because we observe holidays. It is our heritage. It is who we are and who we will always be.
Lately, they had talked more and more about the growing anti-Semitism in the reports on the radio and in the newspapers. Camillo's brother-in-law, Felix Adler, with his clipped German-Austrian accent, so different from the rising and falling rolling Italian the rest of the family spoke, had even threatened to leave Italy when the Manifesto della Razza had been published in the newspapers last July, causing an uproar that ruined August. The family had vacationed in Maremma, just like they had every year, escaping the heat of the city for the seashore. But the Manifesto of Race had come along with them and occupied their thoughts and hijacked their happiness.
Mussolini is building a case against us. He is saying we Jews haven't served our country well. It is our fault that wages are low and taxes are high. It is our fault that housing is limited, food is scarce, and schools are crowded. It is because of the Jews that there are no jobs, and crime rates are soaring, you know?
Camillo had said, shaking his head in disgust. Augusto would scoff. He was always more optimistic than his older brother.
The only newspaper that are printing things like that are those trying to get government money. They spew the nonsense and cozy up to the fascist powers that be. Nobody believes it. Italians know better. But Italians are allowing it. It is being tolerated. Whether our friends like it or not, it is being tolerated. We Jews are tolerating it. We are not so long out of the ghetto that we have grown a sense of righteous indignation. We hope that the worst won't happen, all the while expecting that it will, so when it does, we aren't surprised. You know, Augusto, someone leaned some old rusted gates against the wall across from the cafe on Via San Gianna, where I drink my coffee every morning. There was a sign on them. It said, "Put the Jews back in the ghetto." It's been there for over a week. No one has taken it down. I didn't take it down.
He added in a shamed murmur.
The king will put a stop to it. Mark my words,
Augusto pushed back.
King Emmanuel will do what Mussolini tells him to do,
Camillo had predicted with finality. Eva had heard it all, but they were all old men to Eva. Camillo, Augusto, Mussolini, and the king. Old men who talked too much. And she was a young woman who was not inclined to listen. On September 5th, 1938, a week after returning from the seashore, a new law, authored by the fascists and signed by the king, declared that Jews could no longer send their children to public or private Italian schools, or be employed in any capacity in any Italian school from kindergarten to university. It was the first of many laws to come. Eva had finished secondary school the spring before, and instead of applying to university, she decided to explore her options. Camillo had warned her not to wait to apply, but she had dragged her feet. She just wanted to play music for a while. She was a member of the Orchestra della Toscana and had been for 2 years, and she was the youngest violinist ever to win first chair. Plus, she had 3 boyfriends who kept her very busy. A Jewish boy who played the cello, a Catholic boy who played hard to get, and a Firenze policeman who looked handsome in his uniform and loved to dance. She was juggling them all with no plans to stop any time soon. She was young, beautiful, and life was good. So she didn't apply. And suddenly, that door was closed to her. The morning after the bad dream, Eva awoke to a different sort of nightmare. When she walked into the kitchen looking for breakfast, Santino was sitting in his regular spot at the scarred table where Fabia served his coffee. She said the dining room was for Camillo and Eva, and he was reading from La Stampa, a national newspaper he read every week from cover to cover. 3 other papers were stacked beneath it, and every so often he ran his hand down his face, from eyebrows to chin, saying, "Mio Dio," like he couldn't believe what he was reading. Fabia was crying.
"What's wrong, Nonna?"
Eva asked, going to her side immediately. Her thoughts rushed to Angelo, the way they always did, worried that something had happened to him.
"There are new laws, Eva," Santino said grimly. He tapped the page of newsprint he was holding. "More laws against the Ebrei, the Jews."
"Where will we go?" Fabia asked Eva. "We don't want to leave you."
Eva could only shake her head in confusion. She took the paper from Santino, knowing he had a spare, and began to read. Fabia was crying because it had suddenly become illegal for non-Jews to work in Jewish homes. She and Santino were Catholic. According to La Stampa, the new racial laws prohibited Jews from owning homes, property, or businesses above a certain value. Jewish-owned businesses couldn't employ more than 100 people, and they had to be managed by non-Jews. Camillo's glass factory, Ostrica, had more than 500 workers. His father had started the company, and Camillo had gotten a chemical engineering degree so he could be the best glassmaker possible, and he had made it hugely profitable. But none of that mattered now. Not only could Jewish teachers not teach at the schools and universities, but no textbooks written by Jewish authors were allowed in Italian schools. Jews and non-Jews were no longer permitted to marry. Jews could not be legal guardians of non-Jews. Camillo's father, Alberto Rosselli, had been born in the ghetto. It had only been 68 years since the Jews in Italy had been freed and given the full rights of Italian citizens. And those rights had been taken away again. Now Jews couldn't hold political office. They couldn't serve in the military. Foreign Jews weren't allowed in Italy at all, which meant Felix Adler, Camillo's brother-in-law, had 4 months to leave, and going back to Austria was no longer an option. Eva read the list over and over, examining the language, the details. Then she read it again, not able to fully comprehend what was happening, what had already happened. Uncle Augusto, Aunt Bianca, Claudia, and Levi came over, and the family all talked in varying tones of incredulity until they lapsed into nervous silence as the day wore on. Augusto could only scratch his head.
"Why does this keep happening? Why the Jews? It is always the Jews."
Camillo told Santina and Fabia that there were ways around the laws, and he would think of something. He told everyone not to worry. But for the first time in Eva's life, she didn't believe him. By late afternoon, Eva couldn't stand the black mood in the villa and grabbed her hat and her pocketbook and walked to the seminary. It had been 3 years since she'd visited Angelo there. In the beginning, Fabia and Eva would visit Angelo at the seminary almost every day. It made the transition easier for